Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how green tea helps reduce the risk of disability from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and why, as you age, you should pay attention to your omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D, because they're very important, University of Zurich, and how, from the Science Translational Medicine Review, fasting retards tumor growth. Well, that's good news. Also, greater intake of calcium shows a lower risk of colorectal cancer. That's from the anti-cancer research. And also, I've been mentioning recently about why you should pay attention to the telomeres, because when they become shorter, you live shorter life. Longer, a longer life. From the recent issue of Atherosclerosis, Thrombosis, and Vascular Biology, a Danish study finds exactly that, a link between short telomeres and an increased risk of heart disease and early death. So what can we do to reverse that? I'll share that. And then six body tissues that you probably are not aware of, you can actually rejuvenate. They're regenerative. So I'll share those with you from Green Med Info, Sarah G. Commentaries today, I'll give my own commentary, which I put a lot of time in, that I hope will give us a better understanding of the sacredness of life, the sacredness of the feminine. And I'm going to be offering you some insights into women's lives that I've studied that I believe should be appreciated today. These women should be brought forward today, or women and men should go to their groups and organizations and volunteer. If you want to make it a better world, you have to become proactive. There are a lot of people who are armchair philosophers and behavioralists, but I appreciate the people who are up, out, and doing something. So I'll share what I believe is a plan for changing America and the world for the better. Also today, we will have Abby Martin challenging Rachel Maddow, long overdue. And then I'll add my commentary into that with very specific scholarly information that is irrefutable. Also today, we'll have a commentary from Professor Henry Giroux, Normalizing Trump's Authoritarianism is Not an Option, from Tycoon. And from Barry Lando, Churchill wanted to collar them all. Who was he talking about? And from a Harvard scholar, Kariki Chinga, Winston Churchill, Britain left a legacy of global conflict and crimes against humanity. I'll share those with you. As you see, we have a full schedule. Also, we've added another service to the people listening to this program throughout the United States and Canada, who cannot be by a land-based station, a terrestrial station, or maybe even over the internet, but instead have to listen by some portable device. They may be in an airplane, they may be in a cab or driving, so you can put it on speaker. This is for T-Mobile users. So if you're a T-Mobile user, which is a lot of people, I have a special number for you to call Monday to Friday, noon to 1, and here's the number to listen to this program, 646-233-4267. Again, if you're a T-Mobile user, you can listen Monday to Friday by calling 646-233-4267. So let's begin. First up, we always like people to live a longer and healthier life. And the information we share is universal. So it doesn't matter where you're at in the world, you can benefit from this. We have a lot of colorectal cancer. There are three primary causes of colorectal cancer: a lack of quality fibers to allow the food in your gut to break down, good bacteria to be created and to create a good biofilm, And then for that food to have enough moisture and peristaltic action, that wave-like action, to get the food through the intestine in a speedy manner and then out of the body. In that matter will be dead cells. There will be lignocellulose, and there will be bacteria. And depending upon the health of your diet and the health of your intestine, you should have no problems at all. And if you're having plenty of liquid, that even adds to the benefit. Here's the problem. Most people drink alcohol. That causes inflammation in the gut and in the intestine and colon. That is not good. They lack fiber. They have a meat-based diet that has no fiber. Meat and dairy have zero fiber. So food tends to putrefy in the gut and frequently can be there for days. That is really bad, because then the extreme acids within that food, like arachidonic acid, those come into contact with the sensitive mucous membranes of your intestine. And remember, the tissue on your lips going clear through the alimentary canal is pretty much the same. So it's very susceptible to inflammation. And then if you're under stress, stress is like the, it's like a traffic jam. It just grinds everything down to a very slow process. So by relaxing, having plenty of clean food and water, you're opening it up. This is from the Anti-Cancer Research Report. It's talking about lower risk of cancer if you're increasing the amount of calcium, vitamin C, vitamin D, riboflavin, and folate. They looked at 1,760 men and women with colorectal cancer and 2,481 without, and what they found was that those who had these nutrients had a 41% adjusted lower risk of developing colorectal cancer. Mind you, that's without the diet. But here's the thought. Most people who are taking a wide spectrum of nutrients, more often than not, are also going to be improved in their dietary choices. So take those supplements, eat right, and reduce colorectal cancer. Another study from the University of Zurich shows that vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids are very important. They studied 2,000 men and women, senior citizens, and they found that you are less likely to have fractures, you're better likely to have less cognitive decline, you're at less risk for hypertension, and less risk of infections when you have these nutrients, vitamin D and the omega-3 fatty acids. I would suggest 3,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D and anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 units of the omega-3 fatty acids. And from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, green tea helps reduce the risk of disability, all forms of disability, as you get older. They looked at almost 14,000 Japanese men and women who were 65 or older, and they found that when they enrolled in a program and they were using like green tea and they followed them for 3 years, they found that there was a substantial reduction in those who had the green tea, about a 33% lower risk of those who were taking the more green tea. So take your green tea, and if you don't have green tea, then take green tea supplements, little capsules, vegan capsules, 200 milligrams each. You can take 2 to 3 per day. And a very important study from Science Translational Medicine, it reveals that a significant reduction in the growth of cancerous tumors subjected to short cycles of fasting. The regime was found to improve the effects of chemotherapy, but also work well without drug treatment in cultured cancer cell lines in the mice. So it was as much as 42% reduction. So there was a great cancer doctor, probably the greatest of all, certainly the greatest in the 20th century, Dr. Joseph Issels. And I remember first going to Dr. Lawrence Burton in the Bahamas, Dr. Brzezinski in Houston, in Panama City was Dr. Al-Qaidi, and Rivisi was in New York, Dr. Manuel Rivisi. Michael Schachter was in Suffern, New York. Nicholas Gonzalez, also in New York. And in California was Dr. Virginia Livingston Wheeler. And I had studied all these different doctors, and all had claimed that they had good success with terminal cancer. And the only way to find out is you had to follow these people in their work for 5 years, meaning from the time you came to their clinic with terminal cancer, if you weren't alive and well 5 years later, then their work wasn't succeeding. Well, they all had statistical improvements, more than anything you could find at Sloan Kettering, MD Anderson, Roswell Park, Cleveland Clinic. These were the best of the best. But of those, the last person I went to visit was, and also down in Mexico, I went to the Contreras Clinic, which, by the way, just give you an example of the bias in the fake stories. When I contacted the FDA, asking them about their feelings about the Contreras Clinic, they said, quote, it's like a dirt hovel, that there is no concrete floor, that none of the doctors are actual medical doctors, you're taking your life in your own hands, nothing has been approved. And then I contacted a G. Cognum Woods through the American Cancer Society, who he was the guardian of the McCarthyite-like blacklist, what was called the Unproven Methods of Cancer Management list. And if you were on that list, you were persona non grata. You couldn't get research grants. You were considered a quack. And yet when I confronted him and I said, Dr. Woods, I've been all over the world. I spent time with these doctors. I had access to their patient records. I interviewed the patients. I followed them for 5 years. And they have phenomenal statistics. I said, now, you've written negatively about them. What criteria did they meet that would allow them to be put on a list? And he said, well, we got a list of 13 or 16 things that if you get those, then you're on the list. And I went down the list. And I was looking and checking them off. I said, well, yes, they are a medical doctor. No, there are no secret formulas. No, they're not profiting from their therapy. Yes, they have presented before peer-reviewed literature. Yes, they have published in the literature and present it before scientific conferences. They don't meet any of your criteria. So I have a question. If not one of these people meet your criteria for being on the list, why are they on the list? And he had nothing to say to me. But Pat McGrady Sr., who was the, for 25 years, the head publicist, public relations director of the American Cancer Society, he had a lot to say about it. He was my original source for all this corruption that got me to write the first articles in American history, I might mention, published in a national magazine as a cover story, where the publisher took an enormous risk. And I'm so appreciative of the fact that he trusted in the judgment in my scholarship, because he hired this Harvard lawyer to do nothing but make sure every single thing in my article was accurate. And they were still afraid they'd get sued. But they didn't be it. It won the Audi Award for Best Outstanding Investigative Journalist, but also it opened up the door. From there came 60 Minutes in 2020. My work was on both. Gabe Pressman and all these other people then came in when it was safe to come in. But it was Pat McGrady Jr., a senior, with his son Pat McGrady, who I knew, who was an outstanding reporter, who brought that bunch of material and showed me how corrupt the cancer establishment is and still is. It is just a total perverse group of people. And anyhow, the last place I went to visit was Dr. Joseph Issels. And Issels had a clinic in Tegernsee Lake, beautiful lake in Germany. He's passed, but his son and his wife still carry on this work out in California and around San Diego. In any case, when I went to the clinic, it didn't look like a clinic. It looked like a Bavarian, you know, beautiful lodge. Had that wonderful old world smell to it. And I couldn't find anyone. Finally, I found a guy on the third floor, and he was putting on some sneakers. And I said, am I in the right place? And he said, yeah. I said, I'm looking for Dr. Issels. Well, he's up on the mountain. I said, what mountain? So he took me up there, and each day on this kind of like a grassy knoll overlooking Tegernsee Lake, he had all these cancer patients. And they were having a picnic. And I watched as the doctors, orderlies, took their nurses, took their blood, and I'm standing in the back, and then he big man, I'm guessing 6'6", 6'7", and had this long flowing white hair, and he said, "Now, close your eyes," and they all close their eyes, and he said, "Visualize that you're on a horse. You want a white horse, you want a black horse, but it's a big horse. And you have shining armor on. And in each hand you have huge swords. And your eyes are straight ahead. And you're riding into the valley of death. And there are millions of cancer cells that are coming at you. And you have no fear." And then he started with that. He started to play the Overture of 1812. And it was booming. He had these speakers up there, and it was, you couldn't help but get goosebumps. And this went on to the end of the overture. And then afterwards, they immediately took their blood again. And that's when I first met him. And then we went down to the lab, and it showed a huge, huge jump, one I had never seen, in their immune response and their natural killer cell activity. And he said, "That's the power of putting a person in a position to fight. Not to grovel, not to walk away, but to stand up and fight against whatever their fears are." And of course, so much of the fight of cancer is the fear of the unknown, the fear of dying, the fear of emptiness, loneliness, the end. And so he reversed that. But also, he was one who had the most comprehensive holistic protocols I'd ever seen, he including fasting. And he believed that by fasting one day a week or 2 days a week, you could help manage the cancer. He also took out all infected teeth. He said you don't want the focal infections limiting the immune response. He would help overcome any local infections in the body. He was using Lincoln's bacteriophage, Coley's toxins, hyperthermia. He was doing it all. No one else was doing it all. He was. And hence he had a 16.6% confirmed cure rate with terminal cancer. That means if you came to him and you were terminal, you had a 16.6% chance of living without cancer for the next, being cancer-free for 5 years and beyond. No one before or since has ever achieved even anything close to that. And yet, the American media, based upon its biases, never did a single story on him. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with it. I read where, if it's accurate, where Donald Trump is motivated and inspired by Winston Churchill. Okay. I'm sure a lot of people are inspired by Churchill, and including a lot of people in Great Britain, because he is considered the most respected person in English history. In fact, according to the latest from a Harvard scholar, Chengdu, the current Prime Minister, and in fact, the last one, David Cameron, has called him the greatest ever Prime Minister. Well, he's up against some competition there. You had Disraeli, don't forget. In fact, very recently, Britons voted him the greatest Briton who ever lived. Good. The story that British school books tell children about Churchill is of a British bulldog with unprecedented moral bravery and patriotism. He who defeated the Nazis during World War II and spread civilization to indigenous people from all corners of the globe. Well, that's all good. But as you heard me say yesterday on my program, we only know what we've been taught unless we have the desire to challenge that to see if there's another story. With Churchill, there is another story. because nothing could be further from the truth about who he is represented to be versus who he is. To the vast majority of the world, where the sun once never set on the British Empire, Winston Churchill remains a great symbol of racist, Western imperialist tyranny, who stood on the wrong side of history. The myth of Churchill is Britain's greatest propaganda tool because it rewrites Churchill's true history in order to whitewash Britain's past imperialist crimes against humanity. The Churchill myth also perpetuates Britain's ongoing neocolonial neoliberal policies that still, to this day, hurt the very people around the world that Churchill was alleged to have helped civilize. Remember, it was the little pit bull, because he really doesn't qualify as a full grown-up, who was the Prime Minister of Great Britain when George Bush decided he needed an ally to convince the world that there really were weapons of mass destruction. So little Tony became that person. Later, it would become David Cameron. So not only were they participants in the Iraq War, but also in Afghanistan, and also in destroying Libya, that represented a threat to no one except, ironically, terrorists. Someone should explain to the world with photographs, here's Libya before Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and England and Germany and Italy and France, not Germany, Italy and France, through NATO, invaded it. Here it is today. Here were the standard of living and the freedoms, irrespective if you like Gaddafi or not. You can like or dislike Gaddafi. That's irrelevant. The fact is that Gaddafi had the highest standard of living in Africa, more freedom for women than any Muslim nation in the world, more quality education, 88% literacy rate, which is higher than Great Britain and higher than the United States, more constitutional provisions protecting people's rights to input into the government, thousands of local committees, and putting all of the oil wealth into a central account, which was then divided amongst every citizen in the country. Zero unemployment, zero homelessness, the largest man-made water project in world history that would have helped hundreds of millions of people throughout Africa who are now laden with drought and starvation. Free medical care. A gallon of gasoline was only 27 cents. They could purchase a home for you. If you wanted to be a farmer in Libya, they would buy the farm, buy the equipment, buy the seeds, everything you needed, and give you the key. Gee whiz. What other country does that? How about none? So you could say in some respects that Libya was one of the most advanced cultures in the world and believed and tolerated all religious backgrounds and never prosecuted women. In fact, it was against the law to insult women. Now compare that to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Egypt. So this was part of Great Britain, and this is its continuing legacy. So the same man whose image is polished and placed on British mantelpieces as a symbol for all that is great about Britain was an unapologetic racist. He was the ultimate white supremacist. What did he say? This is not me saying this. Let me use his words. Quote, "I hate Indians. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion. And the Palestinians were simply, quote, barbaric hordes who ate little but camel dung." In 1937, he told the Palestinian Royal Commission, quote, "I do not admit, for instance, that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia. I do not admit that a wrong has been done to these people by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, a more worldly wide race, to put it in that way, has come in and taken their place," end quote. Wow. He has a lot in common with Margaret Sanger. It is unsurprising that when Barack Obama became president, he returned to Britain a bust of Churchill, which he found on his desk, or so I am told. According to the historian Joanne Harry, Mr. Obama's Kenyan grandfather, Hussein Obama, was imprisoned without trial for 2 years and was tortured by Churchill's group for daring to resist Churchill's empire. So apart from being an unrepentant racist, Churchill was also a staunch proponent of the use of terrorism as a weapon of war. How so? What is my proof? Well, during the Kurdish rebellion against British dictatorship in 1920, Churchill remarked that he simply did not understand, quote, the squeamishness surrounding use of gas, that's lethal gas, by the way, mustard gas, by civilized Great Britain as a weapon of terror. I am strongly in favor of using gas against uncivilized tribes. It would spread a lively terror, end quote. But there is more. In the same year, as Secretary of State for War, Churchill sent the infamous Black and Tans to Ireland to fight the IRA. The group became known for vicious terrorist attacks on civilians, which Churchill condoned and encouraged. So the next time, if you're from Irish descent and someone says something positive about Churchill, just remember, he was not your friend ever. So while today's Britons celebrate Churchill's legacy, much of the world outside of the West mourns the legacy of a man who insisted that he was the solemn duty of Great Britain to invade and loot foreign lands because, in Churchill's own words, Britain, quote, Aryan stock is bound to triumph. Aryan stock. Where have we heard that before? Aryan stock is better than... Well, he had something in common with the Nazis. Churchill's legacy in the Far East, in the Middle East, in the South Asia, in Africa is certainly not one of an affable British lionheart intent on spreading civilization amongst the natives of the world. To the people of these regions, the imperialism, the racism, the fascism of a man like Winston Churchill, that little toad, can be blamed for much of the world's ongoing conflicts and instability. As Churchill himself boasted, he, quote, created Jordan with the stroke of a pen one Sunday afternoon. How trite. Thereby placing many Jordanians under the brutal thumb of the throneless Hashemite prince, Abdullah. And that was not a cool thing. Historian Michael Birch recalls how the huge zigzag in Jordan's eastern border with Saudi Arabia has been called Winston's hiccup, or Churchill's sneeze, because Churchill carelessly drew the expansive boundary after a generous lunch. And Churchill also invented Iraq. After giving Jordan to Prince Abdullah, Churchill, the great believer in democracy that he was, gave Prince Abdullah's brother, Faisal, an arbitrary patch of desert that became Iraq. Faisal and Abdullah were war buddies of Churchill's friend, T.E. Lawrence. By the way, that's the Lawrence of Arabia. And much like the clumsy actions in Iraq of today, Churchill's imperial foreign policies used decades of instability in Iraq by arbitrarily locking together three warring ethnic groups that have been bleeding heavily ever since. In Iraq, Churchill bundled together the three Ottoman groups of Basra, that was predominantly Shiite, Baghdad, that was Sunni, and Mosul, that was mainly Kurd. Ask almost anyone outside of Iraq who is responsible for the unstable mess that Iraq is in today, and they're likely to say one word, Bush or America. However, if you ask anyone within Iraq who is mainly responsible for Iraq's problems over the last half century, they're likely to say Churchill. Winston Churchill convened the 1912 conference in Cairo to determine the boundaries of the British Middle Eastern mandate, and T.E. Lawrence was the most influential delegate. Churchill did not invite a single Arab to the conference. Now, to me, that's shocking because if you think of a man who then placed one enough respect to bring them into a discussion, it shows you that kind of imperial hegemonic mindset. The arbitrary lines drawn in Middle Eastern sand by Churchillian imperialism were never going to withstand the test of time. To this day, Churchill's actions has denied Jordanians, Iraqis, Kurds, and Palestinians anything resembling true democracy and national stability. The intractable Israeli-Palestinian conflict can also be traced directly back to Churchill's door at number 10 Downing Street and his decision to hand over the promised land to both Arabs and Jews. Churchill gave practical effect to the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which expressed Britain's support for the creation of a Jewish homeland, resulting in the biggest single error of British foreign policy in the Middle East. And Churchill's legacy in sub-Saharan Africa and Kenya in particular is also one of deep physical and physiological scars that endure to this day. Of greater consequence to truth in history should be a man's actions, not his words. And whilst Churchill has become one of the most extensively quoted men in the English-speaking world, particularly on issues of democracy and freedom, true history, not fake history, speaks of a man whose actions revolved around, in Churchill's own words, quote, a lot of jolly little wars against barbarous people. And by the way, one such war was when Kikuyu Kenyans rebelled for their freedom, only to have Churchill call them brutish savage children. And so he put 150,000 of them into a British gulag. And so much for that. But once again, if that's your bedtime reading, Donald, then I hope that you have an opportunity to look beyond that to the real man. I'm Gary Nall. Now, let's hear from Abby Martin. I think you'll find this shout back to MSNBC's Rachel Maddow the beginning of some reasoned thought.
There are very few people in the corporate media that I actually enjoy watching, and more than just for entertainment. Well, Rachel Maddow is one of those people. She's a seasoned anchor at MSNBC who has a powerful presentation and has made some epic rants. However, she also wouldn't be where she is if she didn't serve a particular role for the establishment. And as critical as she may be of Obama from time to time, at the end of the day, she's there to promote the Democratic Party, which she does quite well by not only conducting softball interviews with prominent politicians, but by fear-mongering her audience constantly about the GOP. Now, I'm not saying that the Republican Party doesn't deserve ridicule. What I am saying is that both parties are equally complicit in the disastrous policies that are destroying this country. But recently, Maddow has gone beyond her usual partisan politics and is connecting obscure dots to make some pretty startling conclusions in the wake of the Boston bombings.
The headline, and I think also in some ways the bottom line, of the Boston Marathon bombing has been that the reason for the bombing was radical Islam, that the bombers were inspired by the online Al-Qaeda magazines. They committed the bombing for the same cockamamie conspiratorial nonsense that we've all had to become so familiar with. But if this new reporting from the BBC and the Wall Street Journal is correct, that may not have been the only conspiratorial nonsense radicalism that was at work here. I mean, really, pick your poison, right? I mean, it's the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which Tamerlan Tsarnaev also apparently had a nice copy of. It's the protocols of Zion, or it's 9/11 truth, or it's what Anwar al-Awlaki sold to Nedim Ali Kassam. There's always been an appeal to this necrotizing conspiracy theory radicalism, which almost always butts up against justifying violence.
Wow. So according to Maddow, conspiracy theories are almost always used as justification for violence. And the Tsarnaev brothers were not radicalized by Islam alone, but were also by conspiracy theories, namely those regarding 9/11. Of course, she forgets to mention that Jokhar himself allegedly said that U.S. foreign policy was the motivating factor behind the attacks, but I digress. Then Maddow compares Anwar al-Awlaki's teachings to people who aren't satisfied with the official 9/11 story. Think about how dangerous that rhetoric is for one second. What does it say about the 9/11 victims' family members who are unfulfilled with the investigation? What about the countless millions of people around the world who are unsatisfied with what the government told us happened and why? Or how about the groups of firefighters, architects, scientists, and world leaders who have also expressed their doubts? Should they all be flagged as potential terrorist threats too? But look, this isn't the first time Rachel has acted as an echo chamber for the government's position on 9/11. She once dedicated a whole segment on her show just to promote it.
Two of the best things ever published about the 9/11 attacks are these two books. I think that was a really admirable approach to try to make widely accessible the findings of the 9/11 report. But the even better thing they did is that they published an official comic book of the same report. It's the official graphic novel, a graphic adaptation of the real 9/11 Commission report.
Awesome. Thanks for recommending the commission report in its dumbed-down comic book version. Nothing like a cartoon to help digest the propaganda a little bit easier. But Maddow's not just selling propaganda. She's also character assassinating anyone who feels like we haven't been given the truth.
This was written specifically to take on the claims of the people who said that 9/11 didn't really happen, or that 9/11 was an inside job, that 9/11 was not actually an attack on our country, but was rather a hoax perpetrated by our government in order to enslave us or something. It didn't work. The 9/11 conspiracies have stood up to the facts disproving them. The 9/11 conspiracies have not gone away because they are too ideologically and, I think, emotionally satisfying to the people who espouse them.
Yeah, Rachel, because someone who wants the truth about why things are the way they are must believe that 9/11 either never happened, or that it was a hoax, or that the government completely engineered every facet in order to enslave humanity. Because apparently it's too hard to believe that this government would not care about the lives of human beings in order to advance geopolitical goals. Is it really too hard to believe the fact that Bush and his cabinet turned a blind eye to let the attacks happen or even ensure that they happened? According to Maddow, it's somehow more comforting for people to accept the view that the government would allow them to die to justify war. But wait a minute, isn't that exactly what she thinks?
That is why the new bombshell reporting by Kurt Eichenwald, which ran as an op-ed in today's New York Times, but is also in his new book, is so important. Mr. Eichenwald, in reporting for this new book, says it was not just that famous Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. presidential daily briefing that the Bush administration received and ignored less than a month before 9/11, or excuse me, just over a month before 9/11. It was a whole series of presidential daily briefs, all through May and June and July of 2001, all warning of a planned major strike by al-Qaeda in the United States, which then, of course, ultimately happened in September of that year. There's a responsibility to get history right for its own sake, right?
Yes, Rachel, it is. And letting 9/11 happen is making it happen. I commend you for being critical of war, critical of many of the empire's destructive policies. But until you start asking questions about what drives these policies, you're doing nothing more than perpetuating them.
Let us take a look at some specifics now. The mainstream media has believed that anyone who comes forward who challenges the idea that we are a nation of conspiracies is, well, a discredited person. Let me just take one example. Yesterday, had he been president, Bernie Sanders would have then stopped all efforts going forward on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Jill Stein would have done the same, but it actually was not Hillary Clinton. She supported the Trans-Pacific Partnership and 44 cables sent to different heads of countries showed that it was completely within her domain to support it. All of these meetings of the Trans-Pacific Partnership were done in secret. To this day, even with WikiLeaks providing some of the information, we still don't have all of it. That's a conspiracy. How bad was it? This one conspiracy, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and these are very specifics, it was designed to benefit the rich and the largest corporations. It allowed currency manipulation in countries, and it would have killed U.S. jobs. There was no enforceable currency manipulation rules in it, so you could do what you wanted with any currency. You could manipulate the price of gold, silver. The U.S. lost 850,000 jobs with NAFTA. Thank you, Hillary and Bill. This would have lost 3 to 4 times more jobs, millions. There was an end run around Congress on intellectual property issues that benefited only largest companies. It gave 9,240 foreign firms the right to circumvent all U.S. courts, including the Supreme Court of the United States. It let foreign corporations bypass U.S. law and regulations and safeguards. It did nothing to lessen our enormous trade deficit of $500 billion a year. It allowed climate change to go unchecked. There would have been zero enforcement of any climate change whatsoever. It undermines the important U.S.-China bilateral agreement on climate change and clean energy. It does nothing to discourage U.S. manufacturers from moving factories into other countries and hence losing more American jobs. It weakened international labor rights and virtually would have destroyed all unions. There would have been a union left in the United States that had any power within 2 years of this going into effect. It allowed all private service to be permanently outsourced, such as sanitation, utilities, and transportation. So everything currently done in the United States by local communities and companies would have been done by some foreign-based company at outrageous prices. And if you couldn't afford it, they would turn off your electric, water, gas. It permitted foreign state-owned enterprises to undermine small businesses. It did not protect a single small business from predatory practices. It opened up foreign companies for public works contracts. It destabilized global finance. It prohibited capital controls and would create international bubbles. It would stop enactment of financial transaction taxes and used to dampen speculation. You would have massive speculation. It would put an end to any attempt to restore the Glass-Steagall Act. And countries would require, without conditions, to accept financial innovations such as derivatives. And those are toxic in the extreme. Banks would become more powerful. Large banks could then sue countries in a crisis to make sure that they were always bailed out. Those are just some of the dozens of problems. And by the way, it would increase any kind of toxic ingredient in the United States where we could not ban it or outlaw it. All foods would be GMO foods. And it would be a big supporter of hydrofracking, gas, nuclear, and completely against all renewables. That is what it would allow. But that's only one thing. Now, for the conspiracies, here's some factual information for MSNBC and the other media that seem not to care about this. Two of the largest groups of full-time conspirators are the Big Pharma and Wall Street. And there are no exceptions. We've done our homework. A team of lawyers working for me have over 300,000 lawsuits that these people have lost and paid fines on. You never hear about them. Let me give you a few examples. GlaxoSmithKline paid $3 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars. Why? Widespread off-label promotion of many other of their drugs, including Avendia, Paxil, Zofran, and Imitrex. What were they doing? They were paying dollars for kickbacks to doctors, falsely reporting on safety and pricing. That's a conspiracy. That's real. They were found guilty. Why are they still in business? Why do they have a charter? Also, Takeda Pharmaceutical, $2.4 billion, settling thousands of Actos bladder cancer lawsuits. And then you have $2.3 trillion to Pfizer for off-label promotion and doctor kickbacks for Zyvox. You had a $2.2 billion for Johnson & Johnson off-label promotion and kickbacks for Risperdal. You have $1.5 billion fine for Abbott Laboratories for off-label promotion of Depakote. $1.4 billion for Eli Lilly for off-label promotion of Zyprexa. $1.4 billion for Stryker Pharmaceuticals for Foley hip replacement transplants. $950 million for Merck, criminal charges for marketing and sales of Vioxx, which killed about 60,000 to 500,000, or two different groups of figures. I'm taking the lowest. But let me put it a little more succinctly. One company, Merck, with malice aforethought, as it was shown, they knew it would cause an increase in heart attack and stroke, promoted this. They made $22 billion in sales. They got to keep all of those billions. No one went to jail. No one was fined. That's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy by the company. It's a conspiracy by the Justice Department. It's a conspiracy by the FDA. They all worked in secret. the TAP pharmaceutical company, the Medicaid fraud, and doctor kickbacks, $875 million. What about all those doctors? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of doctors receiving kickbacks. Not one has been punished. Would you want to go to a doctor knowing that doctor may be deciding to treat you based upon them receiving money for a drug from a pharmaceutical rep? $762 million to Amgen, off-label promotion and kickbacks for a drug. $750 million fine for GlaxoSmithKline again for poor manufacturing practices for Paxil, etc. $704 million fine for Cerneo, off-label promotion and kickbacks and monopoly practices to corner the market. $650 million to Merck again. And then $601 million to Purdue Pharmaceutical, $600 million to Allergan, $520 million for AstraZeneca, $515 million to Bristol Myers, $500 million to Schering Plough, $435 million to Schering Plough. You see the same companies being found guilty dozens and hundreds of times, yet never once is a single person sent to jail. Never once do they lose their charter. Never once does the stock go down. It goes up. And here's why. What are the value of these companies? Novartis, $47 billion. Pfizer, $45 billion. Roche, $39 billion. Sanofi, $36 billion. Merck, $36 billion. Johnson & Johnson, $32 billion. GlaxoSmithKline, $29 billion. AstraZeneca, $26 billion. Gilead Sciences, $24 billion. Takeda, $20 billion. AbbVie, $20 billion. Amgen, $19 billion. Teva, $18 billion, Lilly, $17 billion, Bristol Myers, $15 billion, Bayer, $15 billion, Nova Nordisk, $15 billion. So that is 16 companies worth $458 billion, or $500 billion. Wonder what kind of legislation that buys you? Wonder how that protects you? Wonder what kind of media, when you have ads on MSNBC, on Rachel Maddow's show? Why don't you ask Rachel, why doesn't she do an investigative report on the real dangers, lack of efficacy in science behind any of the ads on her and every other program on MSNBC? Now do that for all the rest. And as far as the United States, 9/11, I'm not even going to mention 9/11, though I've done several series on it. What if you're wanting to know, would we ever allow our country to have a false flag operation? Well, how about under Reagan, Lieutenant General William Odom said, quote, by any measure, the United States has long used terrorism. In 1978, the Senate was just trying to pass a law against international terrorism. In every version they produced, the lawyers said the U.S. would be in violation, end quote. In 2009, Ted Gunderson, former FBI chief, quote, most terrorist attacks are committed by the CIA and the FBI as false flags. 2015, former U.S. intelligence officer Robert David Steele admits, quote, most terrorists are false flag terrorists or created by our own security apparatuses. But what about the 1898 detonation of the USS Maine, killing 266 men to launch war against Spain? That was a false flag. We did that. In 1914, the bombing of the ocean liner Lusitania was supposedly a German U-2 boat did it. Later investigations revealed the explosions happened inside the ship, which was transporting 6 million pounds of artillery shells on behalf of Morgan Bank, and it was blamed on the Germans. How about in 2005, undercover Israeli soldiers admit stone-throwing at IDF troops done by Jews in order to blame the Palestinians, giving a reason to crack down on peaceful protest. How about in the 1950s, Operation Ajax, CIA hired Iranians to pose as communists to stage bombings to create coups against Mossadegh. How about 1957, when Prime Minister admitted the UK intelligence worked with President Eisenhower to approve a plan to carry out attacks in Syria and blamed Syrian government to effect regime change. How about the 1950s Operation Gladio, where the Italian prime minister and Italian judge admit the CIA, the Pentagon, and NATO carried out terror bombings in Italy and blamed it on the communists. In the 1960s, Operation COINTELPRO, the illegal FBI projects. In the 1960s, Senator George Smathers suggests a false flag attack on Guantanamo to give excuse to overthrow Castro. About 1961, official State Department documents reveal the Joint Chiefs of Staff laid out our own Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted to cause a false flag in the Dominican Republic to justify an invasion. Operation Northwood, U.S. government and Pentagon signed off on a plan to blow up an American plane by switching airplanes and commit terrorist acts in Miami to blame on Cuba. And how about 1963? The Defense Department of Defense writes a paper to promote attacks in Trinidad and Jamaica and falsely blame it on Cuba. And how about the 1964? The National Security Agency admits, it's a matter of record, that it lied about the Gulf of Tonkin to make it look like North Vietnamese boats fired on a U.S. ship. It did not. But as a result, 3.5 million people died. Millions have been left with the legacy of Agent Orange. 3 million American soldiers were left with the legacy of Agent Orange, post-traumatic stress disorder, and poisoning with Agent Orange, which the government knew was toxic as the defoliant. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.